Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck. Or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey, this is DeRay, and welcome to Posse of the People. In this episode, it's me, Kaya, and Miles talking about the news that you don't know and then keeping you updated on what's happening with the election that is coming up. It's 70-ish days away, I think, which is so wild. It feels like it felt like forever, and now it's right around the corner. I'm DeRay, at DRAY on Twitter.
I'm Miles E. Johnson, at Feral Rapture on Instagram.
I'm Kaya Henderson, at Henderson Kaya on Twitter.
So, DNC starts Monday, so started yesterday if you're listening. Can't wait to see what's happening. I don't know if you saw, but they announced that Michelle Obama will be speaking at the convention. I'm shocked that they've not announced the AOC or anybody else from the squad. The remaining members of the squad are going to speak. And then obviously all the traditional people you can imagine. So the Clintons, obviously Biden's talking, Kamala talks on Thursday. There are a large number of protesters that are outside of the convention center around what's happening in Israel and Palestine. And then one of the big union guys just got announced to talk. But I wanted to know what are you looking for at the DNC? Is there anybody you're like, oh, can't wait to see? I didn't realize that when they go low, we go high thing came from Michelle Obama at the DNC. Obviously, remember she said it. I didn't remember that was a DNC speech. Let's see if what she says. I hope she says fight these people when she talks this year. But what about y'all?
I mean, there's always like somebody that I didn't know who's inspiring and young and they give a platform to. And so like, think Barack Obama in 2000, I don't know what year was that, like four or something, when he gave his speech and sort of burst onto the national scene. So I'm always on the lookout for like the unknowns, the people who are, this is their breakout moment. But I'm also interested in how they have to do two things at this DNC. They have to, you know, launch Kamala in her own sort of persona, right? This is her introduction to the world in the most formal sense. But they also have to thank and appreciate Joe Biden on his way out. And so I think there is a balance that has to be struck, because while we want to give him his flowers, like this is her show. And so I'm interested in how they are going to accomplish both goals.
You know, I'm a wet blanket, so I'm definitely interested in how they're going to address what's going on in Gaza. I think that this is a good opportunity for them to. There's been enough brainstorming. I think the protesters are going to be there. I just think that this is just, it just makes sense to say something a little bit more soulful about the situation than I've heard before. I'm just not really interested in the celebrityfication of everything. So I wasn't that excited about seeing Megan Thee Stallion. I wasn't that excited about seeing celebrities. I want to get to a world where that kind of stuff isn't necessary or needed, because I think it just clouds people's intake of politics. But I don't have any, I don't know, the Coachella-ification of the DNC is, I don't know if I agree with that. So I'm not necessarily excited about anything particularly, but I'm interested in how they're going to be addressed. I'm interested in like even more. I love the plans that I've heard President Harris, Vice President Harris say.
Speaking into existence.
So I'm interested in more details around that, like around more policies and first day things and first year things that she's going to do. Everything that she said really got me excited. So I'm interested in that, too.
It's interesting, Miles. Like, I never paid attention to the Democratic National Convention until I went to one in real life a couple years ago. And it was one, I learned a lot that like I didn't see on TV and whatnot. And so now I'm interested. I also like there are not many moments where like being a Democrat is fun. And like actually to be in a place with like thousands upon thousands of people who are all kind of pushing in the same direction was it was the like motivation that I didn't know that I needed. And so now I'm sort of excited about watching this one. But I'm also interested. I mean, I watched the whole Republican National Convention this year, which I had never done before, in part because I just wanted to see the spectacle. And so I'm now deeply interested, having like gone down the rabbit hole with the Republicans, to sort of compare and contrast and to like figure out how the Democrats are sort of marshaling and mobilizing the troops. To me, it's an exercise in change management and movement building and whatnot. And so I'm just sort of interested from an intellectual perspective to kind of see how they carry this.
I agree with you, Kai. I didn't know anything about the DNC until I went in the one that happened right in the heart of the protest. And then I was on the transition team for the DNC chair, Tom Perez. And that was like a whole different world. I was like, oh, this is. And what is interesting about the DNC is that everybody in politics on the left is there, whether they're your friends, not your friends, everybody's in a room. And you do get to just see people and make connections in a way that is harder to do. Zoom has made it a little bit easier. But I remember the pre-Zoom times where people like our superintendent, Kai Henderson, people like Kai weren't getting on Zooms, you know, like mayors weren't getting on Zooms. They would be like, come to my office or nothing. And you're like, well, this is a doozy. But Miles, to your point, one of the things that is interesting, I don't know if you saw about the celebrification, that the DNC will have a celebrity host each night. It is the four celebrity hosts are Kerry Washington and Tony Goldwyn, as you remember, Fitz and Olivia.
I know, Miles is going to be like, no, Kaya, but I love them.
And then we got...
what I'm going to do.
And then Anna Navarro and Mindy Kaling are the other two hosts. It's so interesting to see them lean into... I don't know if you saw President Biden give a salute to... what's his name? Martin Sheen, one of the Sheens, who played the president in the West Wing.
Martin Sheen is the one,
So he gives a salute to him. They're like on the tarmac, and the right wing is like, why is the president saluting an actor? And everybody's like, he was the president. Like, y'all don't remember the West Wing? You're like, did you not watch the West Wing? He's the president.
He might have been one of the best presidents we've ever had.
Right. So it is interesting to see them lean into the mythological White House, like with having Olivia Pope and Kerry. Can give the best lip quiver you've ever seen in American history. That like that monologue straight to the camera. Nobody did it better than Kerry Washington. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, what I think about all those people is that I'm reminded that the words that we know them for, somebody else wrote. So it'll be interesting to see if like who's writing their content for this. But Moz, what do you think about these four celebrities? Are you excited about seeing Olivia Pope and Fitz or no?
No.
Shout out to Kerry Washington. At first, you know, there's two Kerrys in my head, Kerry Washington and Hilson. And I said, now how did Kerry Hilson end up at the DNC? But, you know, I'm always kind of just like critical in my head and just always knowing that a lot of times the mainstream media and things that we consume that is entertainment also doubled as propaganda. And I think that there's such a interesting way that things that are myths, things that are stories, but have touched us, that have become another language, can also be used to kind of further a political agenda, whether you agree with what it is or not. And I think seeing Trump do it so clumsily and so insultingly has made me be critical of anybody who participates in doing it. Specifically, some people who I think can do it so sleek and so more organized, like the Democrats. So I feel even more of a need to have a foil, a tinfoil hat on, because I know that I'm being seduced by entertainment and myths and pop culture and all these things that are just in the water in America in order to entice me to vote. And what I really care about are what's happening to the environment, how we're impacting others as a violent imperialist regime globally, and of course around these everyday things that as a new Midwesterner that I care about, like homeowning and schools and roads and potholes.
Wait a minute.
I don't care about your scruffy dress, Kerry Washington, and your lip quiver.
I was just getting ready to say, who is this new Miles? The Miles who appreciates, who wrote the thing on Lemonade, the Miles who is my touchstone for
pop culture
and celebrity and whatnot.
I love that you said that, because I still am that. What I was interested in specifically in Beyonce, in that moment in Beyonce's career, was she was taking African Black radical traditions and infiltrating the white mainstream with those traditions. Mm-hmm. I'm not interested in Black people being used to further the white mainstream agenda.
So
Become more critical about what's going on.
I can appreciate that, but I also think that, and this is why, I mean, you're going to ask me how did I get to schools on this, but I also think that this is an important reason why school is very important. And here's where I'm going. For some people, they wouldn't even engage. They will only engage because they see celebrities that will invite them to the party. And I'm for whatever is going to invite people to the party. Now, once you get inside, the question is, how do you critically examine all that you are experiencing, right? For me, I can leave the BS aside and with a critical lens, assess what's happening to me. Not everybody can, because with the rise of social media and the lack of critical thinking that is taught in schools, people just accept, right? People just ingest, people just consume. And so I would make the point, in fact, one of the things that I've been thinking a lot about is, where do people learn how to develop a critical lens, especially with the onslaught of information? Like, information is available. Before, people used to filter information for us, 3 news channels, you know, whatever, whatever. But now, especially kids, they don't have a clear sense of what is true and what's not true. They don't know how to investigate what they're ingesting from an informational perspective. And so I think we have to start to think about where else besides schools we train our young people, especially Black children who, you know, are my heart and soul, like how to evaluate pop culture and celebrity from a critical lens.
So I will say what's interesting now. So for me, when I was about like middle school, I think my first Bell Hooks book was around like 8th grade. It was like 8th grade. Like my last year in middle school was my first Bell Hooks reading.
Who gave it to you?
No, I found it because somebody gave me, my uncle gave me a Dr. Cress Welsing book, mm-hmm. Which was homophobic and Hotep. And then that kind of led me on Black theories. And I found about Bell Hooks because she was the only one talking about gay stuff and I was gay and blah, blah, mm-hmm. blah. But what I will say is that Bell Hooks was the sole person who was doing that work for me. There is, so the top streaming service right now is YouTube, not Netflix, not Hulu. Yeah, it's YouTube.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there are a lot of people, like, I think about, I do think about Kimberly Foster. I think about another one named FT Signifier. I think about Broey Deschanel. These are people who are using YouTube in order to take pop culture happenings and not just showing people and telling people what happened, but also teaching people how to think. And that's what Bell Hooks did. Bell Hooks, I don't just agree with everything Bell Hooks said or does. No, but what I will say is Bell Hooks was one of the people who taught me how to think critically through her examining those things. So that's still happening. It's just happening on...
My point is exactly that. One, school didn't teach you that. Your uncle hipped you to something that made you curious and made you explore more. And we have to recognize that young people are learning everywhere, not just in school. They're learning on YouTube. They're learning from, you know, familial interactions, church, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, whatever. They like Absolutely. Kids are learning all over the place. And there is great content on YouTube, and not everybody knows where to go. I mean, many people are consuming not the critical stuff that is on YouTube. They don't know where to find it. And so how do we help our young people connect with these things?
I think what I'm saying is I'm like actually like resisting that because the numbers. So FT6, these aren't niche creators on YouTube. These are people who are coming in with millions of views. These are people who are reviewing Drake and reviewing popular movies and dissecting these things. ContraPoints is another person who I'm thinking about. So what I'm saying, and I'm sure if you look at those demographics, the people that you would see are a lot of preteens or a lot of teenagers, a lot of 20-year-olds. So I think younger people are savvy enough to look for YouTube. But I think that critical... Just like my teacher didn't know that I was reading Bell Hooks. My mom didn't know. My mom didn't, like, that wasn't a thing. I found that on my own. So I'm just, there's these underground tunnels that the kids are going to be all right, I guess is what I'm saying. Because I'm seeing that if the same kids who have the same similar thirst that I had for critical knowledge are finding it just in different sources where I found Bell Hooks, they're going on YouTube and they're like, oh my goodness. And the numbers are reflecting that. I think the thing that I was saying about the DNC is once you get into the place with the celebrities, because celebrity is above all else is a class status, it's a power status. And I always think about Eartha Kitt and how she was saying once she got into the White House, all those mothers wanted to talk about the placemats and oh my goodness and the plants, and they want to steal kitchenware. And we've always got fascinated with celebrity and influenced by celebrity once we get in close proximity to it. So once you're in the room with Kerry Washington and Vice President Harris looks so beautiful and she's talking nice and all that other stuff, it's hard to keep a critical, neutral stance in your head and not be influenced by that. And what worries me is that I think that both sides know that and they're both weaponizing it to get their to get their results. And I think when the left does it, I think... For me, I'm even more critical because that is the one party that I think I can push to be even more radical, you know? Yep. So I'm like, yeah.
I just want to go back to your earlier point really quickly. Just, I am excited that you think the kids are all right. If I thought most kids were like you, I would feel good about it. I just feel like we have a responsibility to help open up those underground tunnels so that more kids are seeing those. I want you to put the influencers on our notes so that people who don't know about this can go to YouTube.
If you want me to be a teacher, say that, Auntie Kaya. You want me to be a teacher.
I do.
I would.
I want to see what both of you think, extending this conversation about the creator economy. Is there two things? One is that for the first time, the DNC has creator credentials. So normally, you know, like when I went to the DNC, if you had a sort of podcast or if you were big on Instagram, something like that, you would get a traditional media credential and they would sort of try and weave you in the same way that CNN and the other places got in. Whereas this year, they've invited a whole cadre of people who have Instagram followings, people who have Twitter followings, people who have YouTube followings, and they have a creator badge and there's a creator section, a whole different sort of style. The second thing that I'm interested in is, and when we look at the data, it is true that YouTube far outranks the other platforms, especially for young people. I just saw a poll of 18 to 29 year old men, and YouTube blows my mind. I'm like, I watch YouTube for very specific things. I'm like, how to unclog the sink. I'm not on YouTube for hours. And the fact that people are is like actually a surprise. I have to understand that better because I don't get it. Now, I say, Miles, to one of your points is that I think I'm with Kyle and I don't know if the kid's all right, because when I look at some of these creators on YouTube that I am forced to watch, the content knowledge is at a real low, but the confidence is at a real high. So they say things about politics and I'm like, well, it's not even that I disagree with you. That just isn't true. Right. Or the number of people that I've seen on TikTok be like, you know, critical of Kamala, and they're like, why is she rolling out these policies? She's been in the White House for 3 years. And you're like, well, she wasn't the president. You know, I'm like, you are actually pushing these talking points to huge crowds of people. And the content is, you know, y'all not right. It's not even that I'm mad about it. It's just like factually incorrect. And I do worry about that. I think that like big platforms, but none of the sort of responsibilities of journalism is actually a loss. Like, I don't know if that is a win for us.
So I guess like my first thought is what's happening on YouTube is just reflecting what's happening in the mainstream. So just like I can go on any MSNBC, CNN, Fox News especially, and find somebody saying wrong things, YouTube is not. Yes, that will happen on YouTube too. I do think because there's so many people doing things the same way that, the same way Twitter has, it kind of has like a built-in like irrigation process where after a while you see who, I cannot, what's the black man's name? Lewis, who everybody uses for news on Twitter, on X?
Phil
Lewis, Phil. I believe his name is.
Yeah.
So Phil Lewis, because of a consistency of truth telling and giving information, and maybe also because of where he works and where his background is for a lot of people a trusted place on X, where there's so many untrustworthy people, and YouTube is no different than that. So you will go on YouTube and find people who are saying some of the most incredibly ignorant, false things. You'll see some people who are saying the most brilliant philosophical things, like ContraPoints, released like this video that goes in about Twilight and another one about J.K. Rowling. But when I tell you the places that she lands inside of that video were so brilliant and well fact-checked, and there's actually this type of without sounding too classist, like a sophisticated audience consuming it. And I've seen other people be canceled for either plagiarizing or not saying the right information. So I've seen all those different dynamics happen. So I think it's just different, but I don't think that we're dealing with something so unique on YouTube. I just think it's the new iteration of the media. I think that that's just the state of media right now, is that some people are going to be sensationalist, some people are going to lie, some people are going to misconstrue facts, some people are going to make up facts, some people are going to have real news, some people are going to have fake news, you know? And I think YouTube is not special for that. And I do think that's how come more people like Akiah Henderson, like Derek McKesson, should be aware that YouTube is a tool that a lot of people are using and get on top of it, because it's not going to go anywhere. So it's like, if you know what the facts are, you have so many ideas and facts around what's going on, and you're an expert in incarceration and in police, YouTube is a tool to make sure that you can control that narrative, because the narrative will happen. It's just going to exist like X, Instagram, Facebook, Google. It's just going to be another tool. So we kind of get to make what we will. It just so happens that a lot of times people who are on the right, or people who don't care about facts and more just care about socialization or making money, tend to adapt first when it comes to the platform.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come. Let's transition to, you know, one of the big critiques of Kamala was that she is not doing press conferences, and people have been like, you know, how could, you know, she's only maintaining this popularity because she's not doing press. And her campaign has been like, they're doing press where it matters, which is with voters. And they are talking to voters every day that they are, you know, she just got off or is in the middle of the bus tour. Coach Walls is going to football locker rooms and talking to football players. And I don't know if you saw that they rolled out a whole Friday Night Lights thing with him, that he's going to go to a set of states and go to football games on Friday nights to talk to people. So they have said that they are talking to voters and that's where they're spending their energy. But there was a recent clip where Kamala is getting off Air Force Not One, and she is asked a question about Air Force Not One Yet is what we should call it. And she is asked about the child tax credit, and she does give a response. And I wanted to know what you make of this idea that, like, Kamala's running from the press. And I don't know if you saw that Biden is getting way more spicy, you know, with the press as well, which I actually really love. So what do y'all think? What is your response to that critique of Kamala?
So I do think she needs to talk to somebody eventually. And I think that she knows she needs to talk to somebody too. But I also think that she knows that there's a lot of booby traps in conversation right now. And I think it's important for the momentum to be built. And when people critique, the only reason why she has this good momentum is because she hasn't sat down with somebody. Well, that seems good, you know, because I think the longer, in my opinion, from my perspective, the longer that she waits to sit down with somebody, the more solid this will be. Like, she really is, like, even that the comment with the protesters that happened and that kind of, like, switch, she's really one talking point, one bad thing away from the wave turning. I get wanting to have a lot of momentum before you have a sit down with somebody, but there is a need for it, you know? I think that good journalists, ask questions of our leaders that make us think about things differently, that kind of push the conversation forward, push our leaders forward. I think dissent in interrogation is good for our leaders. So I do think that it could be a really special moment for her, but I get the need to prepare, and I get the need to really build a more solid foundation when it comes to the momentum that she's been building before she does that sit down, because it does feel like she's one talking point away from all this momentum just kind of like shifting or pausing, which could be annoying, but that's kind of like the news cycle we live in right now, you know, and you don't want to feel like you lost the election or did something risky because of one soundbite that could have waited. So I get the patience and wanting to calm down. I think it's smart.
I was trying to think. So one, right, like, I don't think she's afraid of the press. I think the clip about the child tax credit shows that, like, even, you know, just kind of in impromptu, she can answer the policy questions. I think she probably is one of the most prepared folks around, and they don't ask Trump questions like that. They don't ask him substantive policy questions. So I thought it was actually interesting that they asked her a real question.
You unveiled your economic policies last week.
Yeah.
Can you explain how you're going to pay for those? And can you give us a sense of what other policies you want to unveil going forward?
Sure. Well, I mean, you just look at it in terms of what we are talking about, for example, around children and the child tax credit and extending the EITC. It's at $6,000 for the first year of a child's life. The return on that investment in terms of what that will do and what it will pay for will be tremendous. We've seen it when we did it in the first year of our administration. We reduced child poverty by over 50%. So that's a lot of the work. And then what we're doing in terms of the tax credits, we know that there's a great return on that investment. And when we increase home ownership in America, what that means in terms of increasing the tax base, not to mention property tax base, what that does to fund schools, again, return on investment. I think it's a mistake for any person who talks about public policy to not critically evaluate how you measure the return on investment. When you are strengthening neighborhoods, strengthening communities, and in particular the economy of those communities, and investing in a broad-based economy, everybody benefits, and it pays for itself in that way.
But I was just thinking, like, her campaign hasn't been, it just has not followed the regular rules of campaigning, and she's winning on that. Like, the press is the one who got us into this tizzy, right? With their coverage and their, you know, preference for the bad news and the catching people and the bombast of Donald Trump and whatnot. And like, there's a part of me that thinks maybe she's like, look, I'm not going to play on your terms. I'm going to play on my terms. I'm going straight to the people. I'll come to you when I'm ready for you. It's, you know, Miles, you talked about it earlier. She's Beyonce. I'm going to do this the way I want to do it, not the way you think I should do it. And so there's a part of me that wants to believe that, I hope this is true, that she's like, no, I'll sit down when I want to sit down. I'm not afraid of a bad soundbite or whatever, whatever. Because at this point, I don't think one bad soundbite is going to crush the momentum. Like, she's all we got. So we going to keep momentuming. But I hope that this is an empowerment move to redefine the playing field, right? She's the person who everybody wants to talk to, and she gets to decide when and how she wants to communicate. And she's saying right now, I'm going to the people, and people like that. And I think she'll go on a debate stage and she'll sit down and talk to people whenever she decides to. I think that could be an opportunity to shift the power of the press, who right now makes or breaks everybody. And she's got a thing going with Zoom calls and rallies and whatnot. And I'd lean into that, too.
I think also that she's not the nominee. She hasn't accepted the nomination yet. She accepts it on Thursday. So I'm interested to see what the press and comm strategy looks like after that. And she knows that there's no shortage of people who will be ready to talk to her. They'll be, she could go anywhere she wants to have a conversation. Oprah, like, whatever she wants to do, they'll be ready to talk to her. And I'm actually jazzed about that. And Trump, I don't know if you saw the Trump Medal of Freedom comments. Did you see the,
what a train wreck.
What he said, Miles, did you see it at all?
Mm-mm.
So the Medal of, so there are two big medals. There's the Medal of Freedom, which is the medal that civilians get, who the president honors. And then there's the Medal of Honor, which you get because you've done something heroic in the armed services, like in the military. And there's a billionaire who essentially paid for a Medal of Freedom. She's a big donor. Her name's Miriam Adelson, and she gets it. I don't know why he even is talking about this last week, but he does at an event actually that was about anti-Semitism. But he talks about Miriam Adelson getting the Medal of Freedom. And what he says is, and I'll quote, "That's the highest award you can get as a civilian. It's the equivalent of the Congressional Medal of Honor, but civilian version. It's actually much better because everyone who gets the Congressional Medal of Honor, that's soldiers. They're either in very bad shape because they've been hit so many times by bullets, or they're dead. She gets it, and she's a healthy, beautiful woman," Trump said with a chuckle, eliciting applause from the crowd, and they're rated equal.
Her husband is Sheldon Adelson, who is the big casino mogul, and he was Trump's largest donor in 2016. Just for context.
He got the veterans mad about it. And I'm with them. I'm mad. Uh-huh. I'm like, these people, to get the Medal of Honor, you barely survived. And some people didn't, you know, like they are getting it awarded afterwards. And to suggest that that is the same as this mega donor, I'm like, Trump, I'm happy the veterans are holding you to the fire on this one.
That's such an insane thing to say. And to Kaya's point earlier, I think one of the reasons why, I don't want this to sound like an excuse for Trump's like actions at all, because I obviously have a deep disdain for him, but he's so insane. It's like what you want. You can't even do the policy talk. You can't even do any regular talk because he's just so insane. And I'm not I have no degrees in anything when it comes to the medical or psychiatric world, but I want to diagnose him with several things, and I think it's hard to even take him like seriously, even though he's a serious threat, which I think is such an interesting space to be in, where somebody's a serious threat who's also a, like, joke on the personality level. You know, all of our other threats have at least felt, you know, just better written. You know, Nixon was a crook, but he came off as a serious man and an incredible threat. This one is just, it's like, where do you even go in trying to do things? He's just kind of like laughing in people's face about this stuff. Like, it's like he's laughing in the veterans' faces. He's laughing in the face of the people who have been honored. He's laughing in the face of these things that have become like symbolic in America. And he's just like kind of making a joke about it. And like, where do you even start with somebody who seems to me really, really fresh off the, like, fresh hot take. It seems as though Trump hates America. It seems as though, like, he does not like America. Like, it seems like as though he thinks it's a joke, and he does, and short of burning an American flag or peeing on some type of, like, presidential gravesite or something, like, he just does stuff that really shows a deep disrespect and hatred for America that used to not be associated with conservatism. It's odd to witness.
And the last thing I wanted to say that was about sort of the election or politics in this way was about Cornel West. So I don't know if you saw that Cornel is having a hard time getting on the ballot in some places, because the documents weren't turned in on the right time, or they weren't notarized. So he's not on the ballot in some places. But recently, the most interesting thing that happened is that in Arizona, they didn't turn in everything right, and he might get kicked off the ballot in Arizona, or, like, might not make it on the ballot. And the Republican lawyers are scrambling to make sure that he's on the ballot. And that was not what I thought it was going to be. So I'm bringing it here because I was surprised by it, honestly. And I didn't think that he would allow himself to be sort of used in this way, or participate in it. Maybe not used is the right language, but I was legitimately surprised by this. So I thought I'd bring it here to see what you all were thinking.
I mean, I'm not surprised that they would try to get a candidate who might take away some votes from the Democrats onto the ballot, right? That's not surprising to me. But something that I saw basically said that they want him on the ballot and are leaning on the impropriety of the process of him getting on the ballot to ultimately come back and say, see, these ballots are invalid because his campaign didn't do the things the right way. And so that is sinister and tricky. And that is, that feels more Republican strategic to me than just, we want a third candidate who is not likely to really take away many votes. Like, I actually think that the intent is much more dubious than just that.
I would just hope that somebody like Dr. Cornel West would look at this situation and think critically. You know, if I'm in any situation and trying to do anything, and a whole bunch of Republicans in 2024 are trying to help me do it, I would sit down, go to my, what do T.D. Jakes call it? My war room, where I talk to God and reevaluate, should I be doing this? Because people who have the very things that you've written and spoke about and activated others around, there are people who oppose your radicalness, who are trying to help you. And to me, that would be a hint that maybe what I'm doing or pursuing is being utilized for objectives that go against my moral and intellectual codes. I don't I don't know the entire psyche of somebody who decides to run for president. I do think there's like a consistent thing around having to have some level of big ego and maybe even narcissism to be able to do it. But I would just hope that you'd be able to get yourself out of that to see, hey, I'm being weaponized against the very people who I'm saying I need to help. And I'm a Dr. Cornel West supporter. I think that a lot of people think that what he said around Barack Obama was crazy. I didn't. I still don't. I think that he was early around a lot of his critiques around Obama. I think a lot of people on the left are using what he said 10, 15 years ago as regular talking points now for critiques for Obama and imperialism. And I think that he was really early. So I say all to say is I'm not coming. This is not me saying something as somebody who just doesn't believe in Dr. Cornel West. It's just I'm very confused at what he's this era of him. And I've usually understood, even if I didn't agree, with every other era of him. I'm like, oh, I see why you did that critique of Barack Obama. I see why you said this about this person, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I don't get this. I don't get it. Just stop.
Don't go anywhere. More Politics the People's coming.
Speaking of Arizona, my news this week comes from Arizona, and it's an article from ProPublica with an alarming story about the Arizona School Voucher Program. The title of the article says it all. School vouchers were supposed to save taxpayer money. Instead, they blew a massive hole in Arizona's budget. Now, if you are a regular listener to the podcast, you'll remember that last November, I reported on the Republican push for ESAs and voucher programs, educational savings accounts and voucher programs that provide public money to taxpayers for whatever educational services they deem important for their children. I talked about how this playbook was spreading across lots of states, that in the last couple of years, in the last two or three years, 22 states now have ESA and voucher legislation, mostly Republican-led states. And I tried to warn that this was going to be a huge problem. Well, what happened in Arizona is instructive for the nation. It is the model voucher program on which lots of other states' programs are based. And it is the largest school voucher program, not just in the country, but in the history of education. So just a reminder, the law provides that any parent in the state, no matter how poor or affluent, can get a voucher worth up to tens of thousands of dollars to spend on private school tuition, extracurricular programs, or homeschooling supplies. The parent decides what those things are going to be without any governmental guidelines or interventions or anything like that. And as a result, this year, Arizona faced a $1.4 billion budget shortfall, mostly because of the new voucher spending. Well, originally, the plan was supposed to save the taxpayers money by having parents spend less than the public school system would be spending to support their kids' education. But the initial estimates for how much it would cost were $65 million. The actuals were $332 million and with another $429 million expected this year. So how does Arizona deal with the budget shortfall? Will they make cuts in critical services? So there will be $333 million in cuts to water infrastructure projects. And if you know anything about Arizona, if you've read anything about Arizona, water scarcity is an issue that is defining the future of the state. but we're going to cut $333 million from water infrastructure projects so that people can have the state pay for their kids to go to private school. There are tens of millions of dollars in cuts for highway expansion and repairs. This is problematic because the Phoenix area is one of the largest, Arizona is one of the fastest growing states in America. The Phoenix area and its suburbs seeing incredible congestion, and there's the need for traffic and transit abatement, and they're going to cut tens of millions from highway expansions and repairs. They are going to cut DeRay improvements in air conditioning in state prisons, where the temperatures soar over 100 degrees routinely for the prisoners. And community colleges will see their budgets cut by $54 million. When asked what the governor thinks about this, he says he has no regrets. Governor Doug Ducey, he has no regrets, and he considers it his finest achievement and a legacy accomplishment, in part because 11 other states have followed their model. And increasingly, other states continue to follow this model. And so it is, you know, it's alarming. The real deal is only a small amount of the spending is going towards poor children. The vast majority of the money is being used by wealthy families to pay for private school tuition and homeschooling stuff. And I just want to, sorry, give me one second, because I want to give you a little bit of a taste of some of the things that they are using this money to pay for. They can pay not just for private school tuition, but also on recreational programs for their kids, like ninja warrior training, trampoline park outings, ski passes, toys, and other home goods that they say are needed for homeschool purposes, pools, all kinds of things. And the average award is about $7,000. So imagine that a wealthy family can get $7,000 to $10,000 a year to pay tuition or to pay for ninja warrior training. And all of this is coming from public schools, water infrastructure, prisons, everywhere else. Combine that with a tax cut for the wealthy, which means now the wealthy only pay, I think, 2.5% in state taxes, but they pay the same as poor people pay. And that meant that there's a significant drop in revenue in Arizona. And how do we make sense of this? How do we make sense of, as Arizonans, the people who are bearing the brunt of this, of these legislative changes, are Arizonans who mostly don't have school-age children. And we are watching states across the country replicate this. So I brought it to the podcast in part because I wanted to say, I told you so. I'm petty like that. And I'm telling you that this is going to happen over and over and over again, as long as we continue to allow this national push for ESA and vouchers without any guidelines or regulations. I'm not saying that, you know, that ESAs and vouchers can't be good. In fact, at the beginning of the experiment in Arizona, it was only used for students with disabilities, Native American and Indigenous students. Students who were at risk were the only people eligible for vouchers. And then, because that was going well, they blew it up and just gave it to everybody. And who benefits most is the wealthiest people. So I brought it to the podcast because I will continue to ring the alarm bell about this. It's only going to get worse. Arizona was the first. There are lots of people coming behind them. And I think we're going to continue to see these kinds of massive trade-offs where we sacrifice poor people and the regular needs of the state to fund these kinds of programs. I ain't say a word about it being educationally sound, did I? Did we talk about the kids learning more? Nope, that's not even part of the thing. Okay, sorry, I'm done.
Well, that's what I was going to say, Kai. What is so interesting about it is that this is the party that is like work requirements. If you get $10 a month in food stamps and they are pinching pennies for people in poverty to get a meal, And then the voucher program, no educational standards, no oversight. You can send your kid anywhere. Nobody's checking in. Can they read better? Can they not read better? Are they treating your kid right? Is it racist? Isn't, like, literally, it is a standardless operation. And that's just okay. And you're like, yo, this is... It is sort of wild. I do think that the voucher people have done really well on the narrative of, like, choice and da-da-da-da-da. So there are even communities of color where I'm like, you don't actually support this. Like, this is a bad thing for you. But people are like, well, I'm going to get money to send my kid to a... And yeah, it's like, yeah, you're sending your kid to a place. You think that public school was not good? We don't even know what's going on in that school. Like, literally, no... Like, they just hiring anybody. Nobody can read. So I'm happy you brought this here because it is interesting policy. And, you know, the thing about the right is that they are unashamed about it. They are like, we'll bankrupt all services to help poor people to give have the government subsidize what we want to do. And it's like, that is actually a wild thing to just watch.
And I was, as Kaya was talking, I was thinking about why would Doug Ducey like so lie about this, and it made me think, I put it in the group chat, but it made me think about how the House Republicans want to eliminate public education. Like, so
this that's what is, the play is, Miles. This is the that is exactly the play.
Right. So this is a state demonstration of what they want to be, like a national federal law. And that's how come he's approving of it. That's how come he's pretending that this was okay and a success, because their goal is to eliminate public education in America and leave the poor people, the disenfranchised people, even more vulnerable, and make sure that there's so much padding around the richest and most privileged people in this country. And it's sad to see it happen right in front of our faces.
Not just destroy public education, but use taxpayer money to fund the private schools that they want for their own kids, right? And so I think back to segregation academies, which at least if you want your kid to go to a segregation academy and you pay for it, that's your business. What I'm not going to do is have my taxpayer money go to you raising, you know, the next generation of separatists, right? Absolutely. And so I feel like I believe in choice, and you should choose whatever you want for your kid. I don't believe that the government should fund those choices without any oversight and without any, and that is the play that is happening. If they can loosen this up now, even it doesn't matter what happens, because they have government funding to be able to do the things that they want to do. And that is the most offensive thing to me, period, the end.
Because the idea is, and I'm truly asking both of you this, because the idea is, if you are not born in this privileged class, then you should learn carpentry. Like, I'm kind of being serious. Like, the idea is, we always are going to need workers and people to exploit. So we want to make sure that there's not a way to mobilize and have any mobility throughout class. And education is a great way to make sure that somebody who has people who are maids and carpenters for parents becomes that themselves. And education was stopping that for us. That's what it seems like to me. But I wasn't a superintendent of nowhere, but my own. But my own bedroom and house and apartment.
I mean, there is also the like idea of an uninformed public is a controllable public, right? Which is also why there is the attempts at the culture, the bans of books, and the, you know, not teaching accurate history. And so, I mean, it all cycles back to critical thinking. If you are not able to think critically, if you're not able to critique, then basically you're sheep and you can be controlled.
And I think even in a more basic way, I think they just don't care, Miles, what happened. They're sort of like, whatever you get, poor kid, black kid, just like take the scraps. Like, whatever you get should be fine for you, because you're not worth the investment anyway. Like, you, what, like carpenter or just person hanging out in the street, you're not worth the investment. And I do worry that people, you know, think that everything's a conspiracy, and it's like, y'all, they are playing in your face. It's not even a conspiracy. They're not hiding their hands. It's just straight up, it is what it is.
So I come bearing more good news. That's my new thing. This news is coming from PR Newswire. The National Black Farmers Association, also known as the NBFA, has championed a major victory of African American farmers and their families in the United States. After years of protests, lawsuits, and failed bills, the organization, led by President John Boyd, has successfully secured $2.2 billion payout for discrimination in farm lending from the United States Department of Agriculture. The historic payout comes as a result of the Inflation Reduction Act, Section 22007, signed into law by President Biden nearly 2 years ago. Approximately 43,000 farmers will each receive payouts of about $500,000, with the average award being $82,000. These funds are meant to provide financial assistance to farmers who have experienced racial and other forms of discrimination from the USDA prior to 2021. This victory marks a significant step towards justice for Black farmers who have long been fighting against systemic discrimination in the farming industry. The NBFA, founded by John Boyd 40 years ago, has been at the forefront of this fight and has led the way in advocating for change. So I love this news because, I mean, obviously I am a future Black farmer. I think everybody can see it. I think everybody can see me going that way. I'm getting more and more rural in Southern and Midwestern as the years go.
How long have you been in the Midwest now? Like 2 weeks, 3 weeks?
Okay, so the thing about time is a construct. So my spirit has been in the Midwest for eternity, and now finally reality and my spirit have caught up. And now, yes, for about 2 weeks I've been a Midwesterner. Oh my goodness, you hating liberal elite!
I love. No. I am. I'm a coastal liberal elite.
Not you hating liberal elite. That's great.
I reckon. But in all seriousness, I do think that there are certain industries, certain jobs that don't get as much recognition. And I think certain times when we think about farmers, and of course this weaponized Midwestern middle class, working middle class farmer, working people, we always think white people. And I thought this story also illustrates that there are so many Black people who are in this industry. There are so many Black people who need support, and there's still white supremacy manifest in these industries. Or this bill and this lawsuit would never have to have happened. My other idea around this too is, as much as I joke about it and as much as I walk with me, I do think that we're going to see a lot more Black people who are interacting with these industries if the economy keeps trending how it's trending. If rents in places like DC and New York and California and places where people like me who are queer and Black are being forced out because of high rents, low and wages that are just staying the same, I think we're going to see a whole lot of people who say, oh, I want to be able to do this. I want to be able to do something different. Maybe there's an industry that's part of your family legacy that you thought you were going to run away from and or leave, and now you're thinking it doesn't sound like a bad idea. I do think that this fight for equality, even though it feels like it doesn't touch Black folks, it does. And I still think that when you see more millennials turning 40s and 50s and 60s, and when you see more Gen Z get older, I have a hunch that these laws and these activations are going to be a lot more important to more of us. It's not going to feel as niche or as small as it does now. So I wanted to bring this news because, A, we have wins. You know, and this is a win that President Biden allowed, which I think and helped, which I think also is a great talking point. And as we're talking about what has, you know, this president done for Black people, I think this is a great, great, great thing to bring up, because it's not just these kind of stereotypes that we hear about Black people. And sometimes it can go, it can just kind of get stuck inside of crime. Sometimes it can get stuck inside of incarceration and these things that need immediate attention. And I thought this was such a refreshing win and victory for us, because not only did it show that, again, we won, we're victorious, but also we're in these industries that we've honestly in the public narrative have been pushed out of. And this to me felt like a great thing to bring to the podcast, a great thing to think about and to support other people on, even if you have, even if you're never going to plant anything in your whole life, or you're never, or you feel like you're never going to interact with those things. I think it's so, necessary to know what we're as Black people all going through nationally.
I feel like the historian of the group, but this was important, Miles, because in 2021, in like March of 2021, we talked about how Black farmers were getting the shaft from the federal government, the disparate treatment between white farmers and Black farmers, and how subsidies that were meant for all farmers were only going to white farmers. And so this is a correction of that. And it still does not pay for the years and years of the subsidizing of white farms and the dismantling of the Black farming industry. I don't remember what the numbers were, but when we talked about it before, you know, there were, you know, X number of Black farms, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. And now that number has dwindled significantly. And so one, it is important to remember that there always have been Black farmers. In fact, little known fact, during Reconstruction, Black people owned 20% of the farmland in the United States, not sharecrop, owned 20% of the farmland in the United States. And you're absolutely right. We've also covered lots of people who are buying, you know, acreage in many Southern states. In fact, Black people buying farms, buying parcels of land to create their own communities, taking control of the production of food because this thing ain't working for people no more. And so I think that it is, what's beautiful to me is, while some people think that this is new for us, you know, we came here with agricultural intellect that other people did not have, right? There is a reason why we were in charge of, now we didn't get paid for it, but we were in charge of creating the agricultural base of this country: cotton, rice, sugarcane. Like, this country was built from an agricultural base, and we were the people who had the technology and the know-how to build this. And so in some respects, it is a beautiful reclamation of our history and our culture to see people, you know, turning to farming, and to see, you know, us fighting for our right to be in a space that we've occupied forever. So thank you for bringing this, Miles. This was inspiring. And, you know, J.D. Vance says something like, this is discriminatory or something. And I was like, bruh, just zip it. Like, cause if you did an iota's worth of research, like, you just wouldn't be saying anything about this. So yeah, sorry.
Cool. The only thing I have to say is I hope that this is a model for how they can continue to do restorative and repair work for communities of color. As you know, the federal government makes it very hard to do race-based corrections. So I was actually impressed with this, because they were able to do it in a way that had the impact that we wanted and got around the rules of actually correcting for race explicitly. So shout out to the administration, and I hope that this is one of many.
And just to wrap up, because Auntie Kaya always has me thinking about this, and I found this on the Jill's Onion, there is a list of Black folks in our innovations in agriculture. It names Henry Blair, George Washington Carver, of course, Frederick McKinley Jones. That's a really good article that just talks about different Black people in our innovations when it comes to the technology around agriculture. And I think that sometimes, specifically because Black folks have been forced into inner cities or in urban areas, and now urban is actually synonymous with Black, sometimes I feel like we could be divorced that we are people of the land.
Yes.
And that we're people who have been masters of the land. And
yes,
that is a place that we can definitely go back to and feel confidence in continuing that legacy. And I think knowing that, no, you're not even the 1 millionth Black person who is a genius at this, and we can definitely take back this narrative and take back this land. Yes. and that belongs to us.
Stacey Abrams knows a thing or two about not giving up. And on her new Crooked podcast, Assembly Required with Stacey Abrams, Stacey's breaking down the biggest issues in politics right now and sharing stories of action to keep you motivated for the long haul. Meet incredible advocates from across the issue spectrum, fighting for a better future, and discover how everyday people like you and me can help make that future a reality. You can listen to the first episode of Assembly Required with Stacey Abrams right now, wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Thursday, and make sure to subscribe on YouTube for the video version.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Bossy Other People this week. Don't forget to follow us at Crooked Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you enjoyed this episode of Bossy Other People, consider dropping us a review on your favorite podcast app. And we'll see you next week. Bossy Other People is a production of Crooked Media. It's produced by AJ Moultrie and mixed by Vasilis Futopoulos. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Kai Henderson, DR Ballinger, and Miles E. Johnson.